KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The resistance overall is pushing the military back into a kind of rump area of Myanmar.
4 years to the day since a military coup, what is the state of life in Myanmar? For Saturday, February 1st, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, we hear what it's like to cover massive wildfires like the recent blazes in Los Angeles. And we go inside the figure skating community devastated by this week's Washington, D.C. plane crash.
These kids were selected because they were the top figure skaters in the country to train and learn from their heroes. And then in a flash, they're gone.
Plus the science behind all your stress.
When it's not letting up and it keeps coming back in the week, then that signal, your body's saying, wait a minute, I'm here, take care of me.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump signed executive orders today imposing 25% tariffs on imports from Mexico and Canada and 10% on goods from China. He says energy resources from Canada will have a lower 10% tariffs. They take effect on Tuesday. That could raise prices for U.S. consumers on a variety of items, including fruits and vegetables, flat-screen TVs, and auto parts. These countries are the U.S.'s three biggest trading partners. A statement from the White House says the tariffs are to address the illegal flow of drugs and immigrants across the U.S. northern and southern borders. Both Canada and Mexico have vowed to retaliate. Congressional Democrats are warning a purge of FBI agents and prosecutors who worked on cases involving President Trump and the Capitol riot will make the country less safe. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports dozens of prosecutors have already been fired and more dismissals could come soon.
Senator Richard Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois, said the personnel moves are a brazen assault on the rule of law. The interim U.S. attorney in Washington, who once advocated bogus theories about election fraud, fired more than two dozen prosecutors who worked on Capitol riot cases. Those lawyers had been on probationary status, so they lack full civil service protection. Senior Justice Department officials had already dismissed a bunch of other lawyers who worked with Special Counsel Jack Smith to build cases against Trump. Now comes word the administration's making a sweeping list of FBI personnel who worked on January 6th cases. That list is due next week, and it could lead to more firings. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump today says he ordered precision military strikes on ISIS positions in Somalia. On social media, he says those strikes killed many terrorists without in any way harming civilians. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth confirmed the strikes, saying the U.S. always stands ready to find and eliminate terrorists who threaten the U.S. and our allies. In Los Angeles, the two fires that ravaged parts of the city last month have now been totally contained. Steve Futterman has more.
The Palisades and Eaton fires broke out on January 7th, growing rapidly as wind gusts of nearly 100 miles an hour spread flames with frightening speed. One of the hardest hit areas was Pacific Palisades. When he returned the next day, Alexander Gospodinov described what he saw.
It's like war zone. It's a disaster. It looks like the end of the world.
Also hit hard was Altadena. Between the two fires, more than 37,000 acres have been burned, more than 16,000 structures destroyed, many of those residences. 29 deaths have been reported. Estimates put the economic loss at more than $250 billion.
Steve Futterman reporting. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The estate of one of Superman's original creators is suing DC Comics and its parent company, Warner Brothers Discovery. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports the lawsuit seeks to block the use of the character on screen in several overseas markets.
The new Superman movie starring David Corenswet is scheduled to drop in July.
Home. David Home.
But its release in key markets such as the UK, Australia, Ireland and Canada is now in jeopardy, owing to a lawsuit filed Friday in the Southern District of New York by the family of Superman graphic artist Joseph Schuster. The complaint claims the rights to the Superman story under copyright law in those countries automatically terminated 25 years after Schuster's death. He died in 1992. The graphic artist dreamed up the Superman character in 1934 alongside writer Jerry Siegel. The pair were working for Detective Comics, a predecessor to DC Comics at the time. In an email to NPR, a Warner Brothers spokesperson says, quote, "We fundamentally disagree with the merits of the lawsuit and will vigorously defend our rights." Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
Costco and the Teamsters Union reached a tentative contract agreement, avoiding a strike. Details haven't been released, but the union said it wanted a contract reflecting Costco's sales and profit growth. The company's revenue rose 5% to $254 billion in its most recent fiscal year that ended on September 1st. This deal now has to be approved by the Teamsters Union members. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Today, President Trump signed executive orders to impose tariffs on goods from Mexico, Canada, and China. It fulfills threats he has made over the past few weeks and sets the stage for possible trade wars with some of the United States' largest trading partners. The action caps a very busy week in Washington. It was a week where the Trump White House tried to freeze all federal grants and then walk the move back. It was a week where President Trump riffed at length on a deadly tragedy, offering freelance opinions on who was to blame for a catastrophic plane crash. And it was a week where, just like the first time around, it was very hard to get a sense of what actions or statements really mattered. So to make sense of it all, I talked it through with two of NPR's White House correspondents, Tamara Keith and Franco Ordonez. Tam, Franco, good to talk to both of you.
Hey, Scott.
Good to be with you.
A lot happened this week. There was a lot to focus on. It was hard to really get a sense of what mattered and what didn't. So I want to frame this conversation exactly that way. I'll start with this, and Tam, I'll start with you. What mattered this week?
What I would say is that if week one was the fully planned out, mapped out from start to finish week of the Trump administration, then week, and it was shock and awe, then week two was not quite as perfectly plotted and perfectly planned. And there was a little bit more chaos and there was a lot more of Trump being Trump.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a lot like what we were used to from the first 4 years of covering Trump. You know, this governing by tweet, or not necessarily tweet, but by social media, all the, you know, the big puffing out of the chest, the blaming everybody on other issues. I'm talking about the plane crash, of course, blaming it on the Biden administration, on his predecessor, blaming it on DEI, all without any evidence. And then you have the OMB memo, which was, of course, the Office of Management and Budget, the memo that they put out freezing federal grants and other financial assistance across the board, which created all kinds of chaos across states and agencies,
right,
et cetera.
And Franco, is it fair to say when you're both talking about why this matters, it feels like we can take away one, this Trump White House is going to be really aggressive about really changing the federal bureaucracy. It feels like it can do that this time around. And two, Trump's going to put himself into every situation and go on the political attack. Anything I'm missing there?
No, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, to me, the big picture of this week is this is a week that showed all the signs of how the administration is really trying to shake up Washington and exert more power over the federal government. And we're seeing how they do that.
They want the fight. They want the fight. They want to take it all the way to the Supreme Court. They think that they will win. And even in the process, even if they don't win, they will make it clear to America that this is a hostile takeover of the federal government. And they will get some of what they want anyway by sort of pushing out federal employees who just can't take the uncertainty.
So let's shift to my second question. If that's what mattered, what didn't matter? What was just noise? Franco?
Well, I mean, I guess I would kind of want to reframe the question a teeny bit. I mean, I do think that everything matters. What I think, though, is important is that some may matter more than others, and we're just not going to know for a while. It's only been 2 weeks, and there's really a lot that needs to happen. I mean, just take the birthright citizenship that's already in the courts. Let's see where that goes. That could fizzle out. Trump keeps talking about tariffs. You know, there's a lot of things that can that he is promising, that he is talking about, but not everything is going to happen. Just another example, immigration. Mm-hmm. He is making big, big moves on immigration, making a lot of noise, taking a lot of pictures, making a big, big deal of all the deportation flights that are going to South America and Central America. The thing is, the U.S. only has a certain limited amount of resources to do this kind of thing, that I think there are going to be big questions about whether this can be sustained.
So what I would say is over the weekend, heading into Monday, there had been a 12-hour trade war with Colombia. And it seemed like it could really matter and there were going to be tariffs. And then all of a sudden it was gone. And the flights resumed to Colombia. And the White House said, Trump won. And Colombia said, things are fine. And life moved on and we almost forgot within 24 hours mm-hmm. about that happening. It's possible that that was a precursor to many fake trade wars that we might experience. Or it's possible that that was a warning shot to the entire world and especially American allies. And I think we don't know yet,
yeah.
I guess to agree with Franco, we don't know yet whether that will matter or not. But we sure forgot about it fast.
And that's pertinent because we are all talking right now shortly after an announced 25% tariffs going into place on Mexico and Canada this weekend. So that's a big question over the next week. But let me ask one more question about the week that just happened. We talked about what mattered. We talked about what maybe didn't matter. But again, we don't know for sure yet. Let me ask you a final question. What fundamentally changed things that happened this week? Did anything jump out to you as, okay, this is a clear change?
I mean, I personally think that the big change is these attacks on the federal workforce. I mean, I have talked to so many federal workers who are just essentially freaking out about all that is happening. There has never been such an administration that has so forcefully went on the attack of tens of thousands of civil workers, asking for federal workers to consider resigning and that they may get they'll continue to get paid for several months. I mean, this is a significant move of kind of changing the workforce to bring in people who will be more loyal to this president so that he can push through all these changes that we're talking about.
This is a week where Trump saw more backlash and mm-hmm. perhaps in the eyes of Democrats looked a little bit less invincible than he did in the first week. And yet at the same time, he got more of his cabinet nominees confirmed, including someone like Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who a few weeks ago we would have thought had potentially real trouble.
Yeah.
And you also had the White House with this Office of Management and Budget memo doing something that created a potential conflict with Congress. And yet Democrats were the only ones putting up the fight. So while it was a week that made it look like Trump may not be invincible, it was also a week where Trump proved that he is dominating Republicans in Congress. He's in the driver's seat. He's in charge. They're not pushing back.
That is Tamara Keith and Franco Ordonez, who both cover the White House for NPR. Thanks to both of you for talking to me about this past week.
Scott, great to be here.
You're welcome.
4 years ago today, a military junta in Myanmar seized power from the country's democratically elected government. They sent tanks into the streets and detained the country's president, as well as the opposition party leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, among others.
After about a week, people started to come out onto the streets to protest. Hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions, across the country.
That's journalist Lorcan Lovett, who covers Southeast Asia.
The military responded with brutal force, shooting many young protesters, suppressing the protests, until those protesters, many of them, fled to the Myanmar's jungles and border areas to seek combat training from established ethnic armed groups. And that has snowballed into what we have today, which is a major uprising that will probably define the future of the country for generations to come.
4 years later, the military is still in power, and a civil war between the military and the country's armed resistance carries on. Lovett recently visited Myanmar and got a firsthand glimpse of the ongoing strife. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Is there a simple answer? Is there a straightforward answer to who is winning this conflict 4 years in?
There's not a straightforward answer. However, there is a trajectory that's emerging. If we look at the last 2 years, or especially from late 2023 up until now, we can see that the resistance overall is pushing the military back into a kind of rump area of Myanmar, while they claim many victories over bases and they are strengthening. But there's a caveat to that. The resistance is not one entity. It's many different groups with many different agendas and many clashing visions for what they want Myanmar to look like in the future. So it's not a simple situation, but overall we can say that the Myanmar military and Min Aung Hlaing, who's the regime leader, are on the back foot and are in a very bad situation.
What stood out to you? What reporting, what conversations stood out to you from your most recent reporting trip to Myanmar?
Well, my most recent reporting trip was in Chin State, which borders India. It's a mountainous region, devoutly Christian. And what stood out to me, as always on these reporting trips, was the number of young people participating in the armed revolution and how their prospects for an education and families are completely out the window in sacrifice for fighting this revolution. It's always a sad thing to see.
You know, the thing about conflicts is it's not just the conflict, it spirals out. There's so many ripples in terms of how it affects life. Can you talk about other ways that this conflict has affected life in Myanmar, particularly when it comes to food scarcity?
In the conflict areas, and there's many of them in Myanmar, the displaced people are really struggling to survive. In Chin State, where I visited, the living costs in those areas have gone up because the Myanmar military is blocking food and medicine from getting into those areas. The UN has warned that there's an imminent famine risk in Rakhine State, which is to the south of Chin State. So some observers have said that there's pockets of potential famine around Myanmar, especially with these displaced communities who are isolated.
That's journalist Lorcan Lovett, who covers Myanmar and writes about it on his Substack newsletter on Myanmar. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. President Trump signed executive orders today imposing 25% tariffs on imports from Mexico and Canada and 10% on goods from China. He says energy resources from Canada will have a lower 10% tariff. They're set to take effect on Tuesday. A U.S. dual citizen is among the three Israeli hostages released by Hamas today after more than 15 months in captivity. In exchange, more than 180 Palestinian prisoners and detainees were released. This as the next phase of negotiations on the Israel-Hamas ceasefire are set to begin. Costco and the Teamsters Union have reached a tentative deal that avoided a strike by 18,000 union members. Details weren't released, and union members still have to vote on the deal. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Call it a journalistic spidey sense. When you've covered a story for so long, the littlest details can be hints of bigger things to come. In early January, it happened to NPR producer Liz Baker.
I was out hiking near Malibu, out in the Santa Monica Mountains, and it was so windy, I actually turned around. It was so dry, like my eyes were drying out and my throat was drying out. And I did notice, because I cover so many fires, I noticed how much fuel there was. I mean, the brush was really high on the trails. There was a lot of stuff to burn. And I knew that we would be in for something. I just didn't know it would be to this scale.
Fast forward 2 days to Tuesday, January 7th, when devastating fires did break out across Los Angeles County.
It was one of those stories you can't look away, because if you even blink for a minute, you're going to miss something really important. And so I just was up the whole night. Many Morning Edition hits and many newscast spots. Things were happening so fast.
NPR's Liz Baker has the latest from Southern California. Liz, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What have you been seeing?
Right now, I can see a really eerie orange glow on the horizon up to the north, and that's
660 miles away. In Boise, Idaho, correspondent Kirk Siegler was watching the news.
My editor, who's in a different city, and I are watching KCAL, one of the LA stations.
KCAL news reporter Amanda Starantino.
And trying to, determine whether or not this is something that's going to turn into a major national news event and whether or not I'll have to deploy.
But again, not a good situation here in Pacific Palisades. The wind's starting to really kick up, guys.
And I was actually kind of thinking, like, wow, this is probably another, local news. Hyperbolic, like dramatic. About an hour later, I've got a Slack. Like, I think you should get on that 6 a.m. flight to LAX.
So Kirk began to pack. Nomex fire-resistant jackets and pants, a gas mask, N95s, a helmet, protective eyewear. Then an early morning flight to a city on fire.
As soon as the pilot came on to say that we were starting our initial descent across the LA Basin, you could see the two big fires, and we just descended into a black plume of smoke, and it smells, and it's really just kind of ominous. And it's that moment, I feel like I've done this so many times. It's this mix of you're like, okay, these are the last few minutes of calm I'm going to have. I don't want to sound too hippy-dippy, but sort of, take a breath or two and get ready.
At that point that he was flying in, I was desperately trying to catch an hour's long nap because I had already been awake for like 28 hours. And then you woke me up and you were like, my car isn't working. Can you come pick me up? So
yeah, Liz had to come and bail me out. And we basically left a rental car like behind the police lines, not in the fire, certainly far enough away from it, but
I think NPR is going to lose its car rental.
I know. I'm never going to be able to rent a car again. Oh my gosh.
These are glimpses behind the curtain of the reporting process here at NPR. And today we're kicking off a new segment filled with those kinds of details, a reporter's notebook.
We'll start here with Kirk and Liz setting out to cover what became one of the most costly natural disasters in American history. It was a natural disaster where journalists had a surprising amount of access from the very beginning.
California is a unique beast. Like, there's a law that allows us as reporters to flash our press badge and go into a wildfire or other disaster. And that is not the case in any other state that you'll cover a wildfire anyway. You have to wait sometimes days to get in to see some of the destruction for an escort. But in California, you can just go right in.
So you can get a lot closer right away.
Oh, yeah. Like, I'm driving on the PCH, which is totally deserted, and there's like a big black cloud in front of me. I'm looking at, as I'm driving, trying to drive carefully, looking at something on fire, smoke's flying everywhere. Well, I've never seen PCH this deserted. It's just fire trucks everywhere and dark, all the lights are on. And I can smell, you're not just smelling forest fires, right? You're not just smelling burning brush, you're smelling toxins from what you know are neighborhoods and, you know, businesses being burned down. It's a horrid smell, and it's a street and road that I've traveled so many times in normal circumstances, and I'm the only one on it, and it's really surreal. And you think to yourself, like, I always operate with the moniker of, like, it's only radio. Like, we don't have to get that close. Get to the point where you can describe what you're seeing and hopefully talk to some people. And I think it was at, like, Temescal Canyon Boulevard. I was like, okay, this is definitely far enough for me today. You know, there'll be other days later on where I can get in a little bit closer, but it's not safe. But yeah, you're focused on what you can get realistically and safely in the moment, and then how you can get out to a much more secure place to be able to file your story, or in this case, you know, talk to All Things Considered or Morning Edition.
Yeah, I think that's something that people really don't understand is when you're near, not even like that close, but near these fires, the cell signal is really bad. It can be really hard to impossible to connect at all. You know, the cell towers are burning to the ground. And in a lot of places, especially in California, you get power shutoffs in advance of these fires or during these fires. And that makes it really hard, too. So, you know, there's no internet. It's hard to get a cell service connection. So you have to go in and then kind of come out really quickly to be able to report back and just to know what the officials are saying. What's the latest numbers? So a lot of times we have editors in DC or somewhere else who are keeping an eye on all the official statements and like, what is Cal Fire saying on Twitter? What is the county saying? What's the fire department saying? Because it's really tough for us to be in the fire zone and keeping track of all that at the same time.
And that's like the most stressful thing. I mean, I guess that's kind of how you channel some of the stress of what you're seeing is like thinking more about, well, how am I going to file? Because multiple times when I was out there, like, of course, the connection, like the safe connection I'm talking to you guys now on, failed like 45 seconds prior to the live shot. And so you're sort of ready with your cell phone and hoping that the cell phone is enough to, like, you know, get the news across, because you're in this position of like pretty great vantage point and a lot of people relying on you to, you know, hear what you have to say.
Yeah, people think because they're watching on TV, like, we don't have sat trucks, you know, so if you're watching a live shot on TV, like, we can't bring you that on the ground. We don't have that same capability.
Liz, what are you bringing as a producer? Because you're right, like, we're not a TV network. We don't have giant satellites with us. What are you packing and what are you thinking about as a producer in a setting like that, that you probably wouldn't think as much about if you're just like out in a city covering a day-to-day story?
Well, yeah, I mean, connection is the number one thing because you're trying to report, right? There's no point in seeing stuff if you can't tell people about it. Like, that's the whole point of being there, really. So one of the things I always think about when I'm doing pretty much anything on a deadline is I try to get people right away. What's your name?
Brian with a Y, Garcia.
Like, for this fire, I was driving into the Palisades and I noticed some people standing on a street corner.
Yeah, we live a few blocks away.
In northern Santa Monica, and they were looking at the fire. You could see it really clearly. You could see the flame.
Wow, that just expanded.
Going like straight up the mountain, basically, and like flaring. And this huge plume of smoke, and all these people were gathering to watch it because it was a really great view. And so I pulled over right away, hopped out, and started talking to people.
Like, this is crazy looking. I've taken photos and video as it's gone, and this is...
So that's something I always think of is, like, never wait. Just get whatever you get along the way, because you never know what you're going to get when you get in there. You could get nothing when you get in there. Like Kirk said, sometimes everyone's gone and there's no one to talk to. And that, as a radio journalist, is kind of the worst. You know, you can describe what you see, but people want to hear from other people. And so you have to find those voices.
I know you've both talked about this before. At the same time, you're there as reporters. You're trying to get information. You're trying to interview people. But like you said, you're some of the few humans around in this situation. And sometimes you need to just like pause being a reporter and act like a person. Like Kirk, you were telling me about how you were helping somebody evacuate in the middle of all of this.
Right. Like I met this woman in Santa Monica. You know, we're looking around for because we had all just gotten an alert on our phones, too, that this neighborhood in Santa Monica was evacuating and you needed to get out now. And so, of course, we went in to try to find Liz and I were looking around the neighborhood trying to find people to talk to. And there's this woman on crutches, like trying to open up the trunk of her car.
And
you're evacuating. Right?
I am. They finally gave us the evac order.
So I went over to her and I'm like, well, do you need help?
Yeah. Okay. Kirk's going to help me here.
And do you mind? She's like, but yeah. So we actually did the interview while I helped her get out of her second-story apartment.
I have smaller bags, but I'm going to have to make several trips to take. But, you know, you can't take everything. You just can't. But it teaches you a lesson. It's like the things that you absolutely have to have, you look around and you think, well, I guess I don't need the rest of this.
I mean, we're talking about how much you've both covered this, and I think that gets to the big question of what to you felt different about these LA fires other than just the massive scope of them?
I think this stands out because it's an urban wildfire. Like, the Camp Fire in Paradise, California was an urban wildfire, but it started up in the national forest lands and burned into the town. This is just sort of a situation, it's extraordinary, where you've got, you know, a brush fire that started, but then it's really just the city itself fueling the fire across Los Angeles. Like, it's an urban wildfire. So that really stood out to me.
Homes just on fire, apartment buildings on fire.
Exactly. Established neighborhoods, you know, with sidewalks and, like, imported trees.
Neighborhoods you've
trees.
Been to. Like, neighborhoods where you ate brunch, like, 2 weeks ago. Yeah. It's really crazy.
So this is just to really hone in on it. Like this was such a personal story. Kirk, you used to live there. Liz, you still live there.
Yeah, it was weird. So like I've covered a lot of natural disasters on this job and it does feel different. It does feel harder. At first it was kind of nice not to have to spend, you know, a red eye 9 hours traveling to a story and then jumping on the ground and immediately doing a 24-hour shift. Like that really takes a lot out of you right away. And I felt like I had more energy going into this one because I just woke up in my bed and walked out the front door. On the other hand, it's still out my front door.
Right. And you're like, Liz, you're in a situation where you can't necessarily leave. Like I just hopped on a plane and flew back to Boise and up in the mountains and there's snow and I can detach. But Scott, like that's sort of like the little bit of, I guess it's survivor's guilt that we feel as reporters sometimes for these disasters. You just fly in and talk to all these people in full crisis. And then, you know, we get to leave and they're still there.
That's such a real thing and like different kind of story, but same general dynamic. Like I remember after I spent a couple of weeks covering in Ukraine, it took me months and months and months to delete the app that everyone in the country had downloaded with like air raid alerts.
Yes.
Because I just, the act of deleting it from my phone because I didn't need it because I lived in America and there was no one shooting missiles into the sky.
Yeah.
I just felt so guilty and couldn't do it. And like little things like that, like stick with you.
Yeah, it's like we deal with, I think in the counseling world, it's like secondhand smoke trauma. So we do take on a lot of people's trauma and it's hard to detach from that. You know, it does wear on us because people do open up to us and tell us all kinds of things. And it's a lot to take on.
Liz, there's always going to be another wildfire, right? That's a big part of the story. How are you feeling and thinking about that particular moment, having been through this as somebody covering the news and somebody who lives in LA?
Well, as Kirk knows, God knows I know it too, there's always something bad coming next. There's always another breaking news story. There's always some weather or shooting or something. And it just feels so relentless. And I think we really need to offer people a chance to unclench and take a little bit of a breath, right? And you need to kind of break it into bite-sized pieces. I actually talked to somebody who was facing rebuilding their house, and they put it in a very good way, I think, that has been helpful to me thinking about all of this, which is, how do you eat a whale? You eat it one bite at a time. And I think that if you can think about that approach for everything, I think it's helpful. It's been helpful for me. I think it's been helpful for some people who are trying to get through this disaster. And I think it might be helpful for people who are listening to the news and just trying to make sense of this endless rolling waves of bad news that have been coming out.
Yeah, I think you summed it up excellently. I don't really want to eat whale. I will say that.
I don't also want to eat a whale, just putting that out there.
Kirk Siegler, Liz Baker, thanks to both of you for talking about this and just explaining how you approach these stories.
You're welcome, Scott.
You're welcome, Scott. See you soon, Kirk.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. In many countries, AIDS drugs and treatment are paid in part by U.S. foreign assistance. It's through a long-standing program that's been credited with saving millions of lives over the years. But last week, the Trump administration put into place a freeze and a stop work order on most U.S. foreign assistance. Since then, in South Africa and other countries, clinics where people go for their medications have had to lay off staff and even close their doors altogether, which means many people who rely on these clinics for AIDS medication have been forced to suspend treatment. And as Ari Daniel reports, stopping that treatment can mean trouble for the patient and for the broader goal of keeping HIV transmission under control.
HIV was once a death sentence, but antiretroviral medications taken as a daily cocktail now allow people to live reasonably healthy lives.
It doesn't mean that you're cured of HIV. But it controls the amount of virus in your body so that you don't get very sick.
Susan Kuyuvan directs the Providence Boston Center for AIDS Research. She says the drugs kill the virus at different points of its life cycle, keeping it from replicating. They're so effective that HIV transmissions plummeted between sexual partners and from mothers to children.
Any person who has HIV has been given a life. Stopping antiretroviral therapy means death, means sickness.
And this is why. Let's say someone's taking their HIV medications and then for some reason they stop. The drug levels begin to drop in their body. That's when the virus comes out from hiding. Chris Byrer directs the Duke Global Health Institute.
There are viral reservoirs of HIV in the body. We don't know where all of them are, but either way, the virus will come back.
Meaning that within days or weeks after a person stopped taking their meds, the patient will come down with what feels like a dreadful flu.
You're achy, you have night sweats, you have fever. And some people, they may feel like they're acquiring HIV all over again with rash and high fever, headaches, nausea.
The disease will then progress.
Eventually, all those people will develop clinical AIDS and the very serious complications, like opportunistic infections, that a healthy immune system protects you from.
Everything from shingles to fungal and parasitic infections to, especially in Africa and Asia, tuberculosis, any one of which can kill someone without a functioning immune system. But here's the other problem with stopping antiretroviral treatment. During the period when drug levels in the body are declining and viral levels are growing, that's when the virus is most likely to become resistant.
Because you don't have enough drug in the body to fully suppress replication. And if you develop resistance to one of these antivirals, you generally are resistant to the whole class.
Forcing someone to move on to a second or third line regimen of drugs that are pricier and harder to get. Plus,
if you do have a resistant virus, you can transmit it.
These are the reasons why public health experts like Susan Kuyuvan are so worried.
Without antiretroviral therapy, the virus comes back in revenge.
And without intervention, she says, death from AIDS is all but certain. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
This is NPR News.
The Grammy Awards Sunday will spotlight not just one or two new stars, but an entire new generation of pop divas.
If you told me at the same time last year that all of these people would be some of the biggest names in pop music and on the Grammy stage tonight, I wouldn't have believed you.
Tune in for a preview of music's biggest night and performances, Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. President Trump fired the head of the country's consumer financial watchdog today, a move that was expected. Rohit Chopra was known for his aggressive enforcement and expansion of consumer protection laws. His five-year term was to have ended next year. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is taking his first trip as the Trump administration's top diplomat, traveling to Panama today. He will also visit El Salvador, Costa Rica, Guatemala, and the Dominican Republic. And the U.S. Copyright Office has issued guidelines on what artwork can be copyrighted, saying creative works produced using AI have to show a degree of human agency in them in order to be registered for a copyright. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm, Arm.com. From Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. The figure skating community is still reeling from Wednesday's mid-air collision between an American Airlines jet and an Army helicopter over Washington, D.C. 14 people on that aircraft had ties to figure skating, established coaches, rising stars, parents, and family members of skaters. They were all returning from a figure skating competition in Wichita, Kansas. Robert Samuels is a Washington Post reporter who covered that competition and has since been reporting on how the crash has upended the skating world. Welcome.
It's good to be here. Thank you, Scott.
You were just in Boston because the Skating Club of Boston lost six people in this crash, including two coaches. What were those conversations like?
They were hard. The figure skating community is a very interconnected community, very insular, and very emotional. There was a lot of conversation between coaches and younger skaters about the power of returning to the ice and being strong. But then they'd look to a particular corner where Gina Hahn or Spencer Lane, two of the young skaters who died, used to sit, and they'd find themselves breaking down. And so it's a community, it's a club that's really trying to reestablish itself and get itself ready for all of the things that it has to do.
Yeah. I feel like when somebody dies in this sort of way at a young age, there's this period of time where you just don't really believe that that actually happened. Like, I can't imagine the different feelings and emotions on the ice at practice in Boston right now.
Well, I mean, could you imagine that you saw these people, they're Snapchatting you going on to that flight? They had just really had one of the best moments of their lives. These kids were selected because they were the top figure skaters, young figure skaters in the country, to get extra help to train and learn from their heroes. And then in a flash, they're gone. It's also important to say that the Figure Skating Club of Boston in 1961 There was a terrible plane crash on the way to the World Championship, and the entire world figure skating team was lost at that point. Half of the people who are on that plane were from the Skating Club of Boston.
Wow.
So that club, it has this legacy that it had always tried to rebuild from the shadow of this. And now here they are rebuilding again.
And you had just been, you had been in Wichita for the competition that, that happened ahead of this, this training camp. I'm wondering, are you having conversations with people that you saw in a much different setting a few days before reporting on a competition, reporting, you know, I was reading your stories, and it's just about the competition, the energy of these skaters, and then a few days later, it's just like a wildly different story. As a reporter, as somebody who covers and really appreciates this world, how have you sorted through the wildly disparate conversations that you're having with the same people in one setting and then a wildly different one?
The shock that I feel just as a human being, those kids, the kids in the development camp, when they're at the national championships, they were right in front of me. And there was such jubilation. They danced, they cheered the loudest. They wanted people to notice them. And the jubilation of older skaters who went to see young talents like Ilya Malinin, who's from the DC area, land quadruple axels, Amber Glenn, the American champion, landing triple axels. Those were the conversations we had about just how strong the American figure skating program was.
Yeah.
And to then have to call those people on Thursday morning, it's a little tricky as a reporter, I'll be honest with you, because you usually talk to them about something they love. And that's a very hard conversation to broach because the first thing you want to do is make sure they're okay. And the next thing you want to do is to be able to help them tell a story that they're still processing in real time while you're still processing it.
Mm-hmm. Robert, you cover a lot of different things. You write a lot about a lot of different things. I should say you won a Pulitzer Prize for reporting on George Floyd's life. What is it about figure skating, the sport, the community, that has drawn you so much, that has interested you so much over the years?
Yeah, well, I've never figure skated. I've been on ice a few times in my life. But early on, when I was a kid, I noticed that there was something really thrilling about being a figure skater. I loved the idea of a single person going out there on a sheet of ice, and they had 4 minutes to try to prove something to the world. And if they made a mistake, that was it. It takes a lot of resilience and strength. And then when you go to a championship and you see someone who, you know, it's not going to be on a Wheaties box, but they have dedicated their life to this. And they jump, and you hear that thud when they have a bad fall. Sometimes you can even hear the reverberations on the board. And you see them get up. You realize that there's something really special about someone who tries to do this sport.
Yeah. That's Robert Samuels of the Washington Post. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Anytime, Scott. Have a good day.
Thank you. Are you feeling stressed? If the answer is yes, you are not alone. In fact, we all experience stress at some point in our life. It is a hard truth that science educator Kate Bieberdorf, also known as Kate the Chemist, has been facing a lot recently. In this episode of her podcast with KCUR, Seeking a Scientist, she set out to understand the science behind everyday stress and some helpful ways to cope.
Life update. I just made a pretty big, exciting, but also super stressful change. After 16 years in Austin, Texas, I moved across the country and started a new job as the United States' first professor for the public understanding of science at the University of Notre Dame.
Yes! I'm Kate the Chemist.
She's nationally known for breathing fire, explosions, and major TV appearances. And now her mission is to bring that same notoriety to Notre Dame.
A new school, a new home, a new job. The laundry list of stressful things felt endless. And when we checked in with you, you shared that there were a lot of things stressing you out, too.
What do I want to do? What is my career going to be?
The uncertainty.
Everyday life is stressful.
Is there enough money?
Driving. Stacking my to-do list too high.
The way people perceive me, that stresses me out.
You know, am I taking care of the house and myself and this and that?
So I think we can all agree that stress is sometimes, unfortunately, a major part of life. And it can manifest itself in a number of different ways. It might be that uneasy feeling in your stomach, tiredness or an inability to sleep, forgetfulness, maybe your heart racing or headaches, even depression. Yet not all stress is bad stress. Some of us thrive on it.
Am I addicted to stress? I feel weird when I'm not stressed.
There are certain levels of stress that you have to go through to grow as a person.
When that adrenaline level kicks in and everything starts firing.
Oof. This is me. Like when Al Roker says, please welcome to the stage, Kate the Chemist.
Kate the Chemist.
Kate the Chemist.
I get this massive surge of adrenaline and dopamine, and that dynamic duo helps me perform on live TV. Yet for some introverts, there's not enough adrenaline on the planet to convince them to step in front of a camera. So I've always wondered if we have the exact same molecules bouncing around in our bodies and brains, how can we have such different responses to them? And is our stress getting worse?
Could it be that a society gets so stressed out that it actually starts to break?
So I'll admit it, I'm kind of a control freak. And during my big move, all the things I normally can handle were just out of whack. And I was really struggling. I had a conversation with my friend, neurobiologist Kosik C at the Sowers Institute, and asked him why I felt so off.
I think in the modern life, we worry so much, we want to control every aspect of our life, and that's actually stress. We do not accept that the life has unexpectedness built within it.
The unknown can be scary, especially if you're uprooting your life to chase after your dream job.
Many times in the modern life, our quest to be eternally happy, I think that causes a lot of stress on us. And the moment we are not feeling happy, we feel we are stressed. But I don't think we should equate those.
Kosik's point is that even in a healthy environment, anything that sets us off our path toward eternal happiness could cause us stress. And that's one of the reasons why stress is a really challenging topic for scientists to study. It's a nuanced area of brain research.
Essentially, nobody would debate that the stress has an impact on how we function, how we form memory, how to do anything. But what the debate is about where the stress is exactly acting on.
So Kosik helped me connect with the queen of stress science herself, Dr. Rajita Sinha. She's a psychiatry and neuroscience professor and the founder of the Yale Stress Center, where a team of scientists are using brain images to collect stress data.
We quantify it many ways. It's multi-level, so you quantify the stressors people have faced. You quantify their body's response, you know, up and down, the signs and symptoms. All of this is new, actually, in many ways. So that's what's exciting about it.
So from a scientific perspective, how would you define stress?
The experience of feeling challenged, feeling pressured, threatened, or overwhelmed, or the pain and distress of that experience can all be part of what we think of when we think of stress.
What would a common stressor be?
There are so many different types of stressors, right? Somebody is chasing you, threatening you in a way that you need to run for your life, or somebody, God forbid, points a gun at you or a weapon at you. There are, you know, climate-related sort of stressors. You've got a hurricane coming, your house is going to be exposed to some drastic external things. But there's work-related stress, and there's family stress, balancing that. That's the pressure of, you know, you've got too much to do. But there are also internal stressors. So if your body's recovering from an illness, or you are in acute pain or chronic pain, or have, God forbid, extreme hunger or extreme sleeplessness, for example, those can all be situations that drive the stress response and that make us stressed.
Biologically, is there a reason why we experience stress? So you talked about the gun example or running for your life. So what happens in those moments specifically?
We have a very robust biology of stress. We have a hardwired response, a whole system and substrate for responding because we are wired for survival, both individually to survive, but also for a species.
Let's say you're going for a hike and then suddenly a bear appears. In that split second, your amygdala, the part of your brain that handles our emotions, will send an SOS signal to your hypothalamus. I like to think of the hypothalamus as those 1950s telephone operators.
Long distance.
Operator.
It's the section of our brain that uses our nervous system to send lightning-fast messages to the rest of our body. That's how we know to freeze or run in an instant. That response is what we've come to call fight or flight or tend or befriend. But Rajita says this is only one part of the stress response.
Because if you think of the survival mode, that has very much driven the thinking about fight or flight and freeze. But that is not the only thing we do. We do a lot more than surviving. In fact, what we've learned, what the new science of stress, what I like to call the new science of stress, has taught us is that we're learning about cells and neurons, our brain cells, but cells in our body. And one of the things that's very critical and main function of the biological stress system is adaptation.
In fact, research out of the Max Planck Institute of Molecular Cell Biology and Genetics shows that our cells know when we're in a stressful situation, and they form membrane-less compartments that help us survive in the moment and then recover more easily after the stressor has been eliminated. However, it's possible that the trauma from the experience can stay with you and continue to cause you further stress. And what about the things in life that are constant?
Yes, there's the run thing and you took care of it. But now you can't run anywhere and you can't sleep. Well, what is sleeplessness telling you? It's telling you it's like a stress sign. People would say, but how do I know when I should care about it? You know, because sometimes I'm stressed and then I'm okay. I talk to my friend and I'm fine. So we would say when it's not letting up, when it comes back and it keeps coming back in the week, then that signal, your body is saying, wait a minute, I'm here, take care of me.
When your body is sending off those alert signals to take care of yourself, that's when you need what Dr. Rajita Sinha refers to as a stress buster. For me, it's yoga or a kickboxing class. For my hubby, it's 30 minutes with his Kindle. Rajita, do you have some stress busters that you'd recommend?
What I call the low-hanging fruit is what we should all be considering. Exercise is good. Talking to a friend or a family member, somebody you're close to, just talking. Our body is actually wired to partake in these things to help us reset. Nutrition is really important. Being outdoors, being in pleasant environments. And then some people have other ways, really ice cold towel on their face or take even a cold plunge, which some people like to do. So there's lots of different stress busters. And in fact, just as stress is uniquely individual in many ways in the way that we experience it, the stress busters are uniquely individual. I had one person, I said, well, what do you do to take care of your stress? And they go to a drumming class twice a week. Well, that's fantastic, because when we break down the science of this, it's really neat, because we use our muscles and our body to send signals up to the brain for resetting. And that is just beautiful.
That was an excerpt from the KCUR podcast, Seeking a Scientist, hosted by Kate the Chemist. It is made possible by the Stowers Institute for Medical Research. You can hear more episodes wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
Mm-hmm.